Well, welcome to the Bill Bennett Show. It's the podcast that translates Donald Trump as if he needed translation. All too plain to a lot of his critics. We take a look at the current administration. We look at policy. We address the existential threats to America. Today we'll hear from Joel Farkas. You've heard from him before. He's our California expert. California dreaming, California declining. I also want to talk to him about trade and the China trade and tariff business and doing business in China. He's a very successful businessman, and he's a director of the American Strategy Group. I'm a fellow at the American Strategy Group here in Washington. We will get Joel's perspective on the China trade war, and we'll also take a deeper look at homelessness in America. And we'll also hear from Max Eden. He joins me today. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We'll talk about his new book, Why Meadow Died, The People and Policies That Created the Parkland Shooter and Endanger America's Students. This is an eye-opening book and account. I want you all to listen to this. Claude, I want to talk to you about this. I want to just give you the facts. Our friend Heather MacDonald from the Manhattan Institute, she studies crime, police, murder, trends, rates. And she was on Martha McCallum show, and she said a couple of things that were very interesting. She said, "My heart goes out to the victims in Texas, but these mass shootings need to be compared to the daily carnage that's going on in America's inner cities. If the Democrat contenders," she said, "really wanted to make a dent in gun violence in this country, they'd stop demonizing the cops. They would support proactive policing, because the majority of gun violence is going on in our inner cities can be helped and solved by cops." Here's the statistics. Listen to this. 20 black people a day are killed in gun violence. That's more than all white and Hispanic homicide victims combined.
Wow.
Data. According to CDC data, there were 14,542 gun homicides in 2017. That's the latest year for which that data is available. 8,500 of the 14,500 were black or African-American. This works out to more than 23 a day. This year, we've had 142 victims of mass shootings. The shooting in Odessa and Midland brings the number of mass killings in the U.S. so far this year to 25, matching the number in all of 2018. That's not a good direction. Number of people killed this year in these mass shootings is 142. 142 in the mass shootings. In the one-at-a-time shootings, homicide shootings, we have about 15,000 gun homicide victims. Over half of these will be black. Got the scale here? 143 mass shooting victims. More than 15,000 gun homicide victims. And over half of those are black people. What are we trying to address? What McDonald says, I'll use her words. The mainstream media and the Democratic establishment, if you listen to them, don't give a damn about black lives unless a white officer is involved. Now, that's, you know, that's a very provocative Heather. But if you look at the emphasis is all on these mass killings, which are horrible, terrible, and frightening. And look, there's a sensationalistic aspect to the mass killing. It's a mass killing that catches our attention. That frightens us, that makes us think we're all vulnerable. In a way, that shootings going on in the inner city doesn't make us all feel vulnerable because we don't live there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if human lives matter, and if black lives matter, to use the phrase, there ought to be some much different proportionality in our discussion. 143 mass killings, 15,000, if you will, shot-at-a-time killings.
Well, I mean, you said the one word that is a good starting point is attention. Not even paying attention to it. But yet, you're the champion of the minority. And one of the biggest issues, I mean, you talk about parents. I mean, you know, listen, as a young black male raised by a single mom after my father died, I mean, she had talks about police. But she also had talks about the guys hanging out on the corner.
Yep.
You don't want to hang around those guys.
Yep.
You know, stay off the street when you see these guys. And those are just as, you know, those conversations that have to be had as far as that's concerned is just as real as any other conversation that has to be had. But yet we're not having it.
Numbers. Mass murders, 142 people have been killed this year, 2019.
Mm-hmm.
Through Sunday, August 25th, in Chicago, 330 people have been killed.
Mm-hmm.
Just in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
No mass murder there.
Right.
Individual murder, more than half of those are black. In Chicago, I'm guessing, two-thirds.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. I mean, this is striking, and it's disturbing, and I think Heather has a point. The mass shootings grab our attention in a way these individual shootings don't, because they're mass shootings. They are these spectacles of violence. And because there's a kind of surprise, you know, you're at the nightclub, you're at the place in Dayton, you're at the Walmart, and the movie theater. And somehow, no surprise when it comes to these individual killings in the inner cities. Because we're not shocked or surprised anymore.
Well, and if you're talking about even gun control, you know, I don't have any numbers, but I don't imagine a lot of the one-on-one killings in the streets are done by individuals who, you know, have permits, went through background checks and bought their guns legally. You know, why isn't that the amount of illegal guns on the streets in inner cities killing other black people? Why isn't that part of the gun control debate as well?
You know, what also is true about those guns, they're not AK-47s.
Right.
They're not AR-15s. They're handguns. You see these little children in Southside Chicago killed by a stray bullet. It's a guy driving by in a car.
I mean, just recently here in D.C., there was a birthday party for a 2-year-old, for some kid, and an argument breaks out outside, and someone takes out a gun and shoots someone, and a kid gets hit by a bullet.
Yeah, I saw that. I think you're right where you started. Attention must be paid. And it's eye-opening. Those are the statistics. I had people at Fox check the numbers to be sure they were exact. But it's eye-opening. My last thought on this homicide business, mass murders versus what we're calling the retail inner-city murders, is they're both awful.
Right, right.
I think you have to, if you're honest, take a thoughtful and careful look and take into account and make as central, if you care about the lives of children, if you care about the lives of black children, what goes on in these cities every day, and begin to address it. And I think Heather McDonald is right that the police, and not making the police the enemy, is the best way to address it.
Right.
But second, we also are making room in this podcast for a discussion of one of the worst and most avoidable mass murders in recent history, what happened at Parkland, Florida.
Right.
Because that's awful, too. And maybe, I just don't know. I'd love to know what the listeners think when they're done with this podcast.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
Joining me now is Max Eden, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of the book Why Meadow Died, The People and Policies That Created the Parkland Shooter and Endanger America's Students. The book is out, right, Max?
Yes, it is out today. You can have it on Amazon.
Wonderful. You're getting a lot of interest in this book, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting topic, and it's kind of one of those things where the immediate play of it, right, the immediate political valence, the immediate debate is so far from the point, and in many ways the exact opposite of the point, that it's almost kind of turning on its head the conventional wisdom of what one of the most significant tragedies of the past decade really meant.
The book is Why Meadow Died, by Andrew Pollack and Max Eden. The cover says, "The people and policies that created the Parkland shooter and endanger America's students." Let's ask you this opening question, then we'll unpack it in pieces. Who is Meadow, and why did Meadow die?
Meadow is Andrew Pollack's daughter, his youngest child. She was a senior in high school. She had been accepted to college, was looking forward to being done with the whole high school thing. And she was on the third floor of the 1200 building on Valentine's Day 2018 when a gunman entered the room or entered the building, and the fire alarm went off. She went into the hallway in the direction of her teacher, and she was shot 9 times on the third floor. And, you know, she died for many reasons. And Andrew, after starting to learn enough of it at the end of the day, only blames the shooter for half of it. The other half he puts on Broward County, the police, the mental health authorities, but most especially the school. You know, the shooter's journey through the school system and the decisions that were made around him were so bad, so recklessly irresponsible, that eventually, once we learned a lot of the story, Andrew approached the killer's defense attorney and said, "If you give me all of his educational record, I will testify as a witness for the defense, because it matters more to me that I can expose the sick system that I hold just as responsible than that he gets the death penalty at the end of the day."
Well. Let's just the simple questions. This is, we're referring to the shooting that occurred when? Killings that occurred when?
February 14th, 2018 at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida.
Police chief was named?
The police chief was Sheriff Scott Israel.
Right. We saw him all over. Principal's name? Principal of the high school?
Ty Thompson.
And the superintendent of schools?
Robert Runce.
Why did Meadow die?
Meadow died because a shooter who everybody knew was a ticking time bomb was perpetually cast aside. Consistent, irresponsible decisions were made about him. They knew he was a ticking time bomb. They threw him out the back door, hoping that he wouldn't explode in the school, and he did. And, you know, I think there are a couple aspects to what happened that I think can relate to larger themes. So I'll say, you know, two things directly that day that I think speak to a broader story. One thing is when the shooter walked out of the Uber through an open gate that was supposed to be locked, he was seen by a security officer who recognized him as Crazy Boy, thought to himself, that's the guy that we had the meeting that he would shoot up the school. And I see that he's carrying a black canvas rifle bag, but I don't want to approach him because maybe he has a handgun and maybe he'll shoot me. So I don't want to call in anything because I don't want to cause undue alarm. And even after I hear what are almost unmistakably gunshots sounding out from within the school, I don't want to call a code red to alert students to have a lockdown because, you know, I didn't see the weapon and maybe if it's not really happening, I'll get in trouble. So one reason why Meadow died was because there was no code red called because the security officer was so concerned with how he would look that in the course of a mass murder, he didn't want to call a code red to risk looking bad. You know, another reason that speaks to the same theme is Meadow is in the third floor that day in the hallway. She tries to get into the women's bathroom, but the women's bathroom is locked because the assistant principal wanted to deter vaping. E-cigarettes, maybe THC in there, without having to enforce the rules, issue consequences, because the entire district was under this pressure to fight the so-called school-to-prison pipeline by lowering suspensions, expulsions, and arrests. And in this case, they responded to it by locking bathrooms to deter vaping that ended up being another cause for why she couldn't get to safety that day.
Let's talk about the shooter and his history at the school. You mentioned the security guard saying Crazy Boy. Was he referred to as Crazy Boy?
It appears so informally. I mean, this is a student from a young age was obviously deeply disturbed. You know, he was kicked out of early pre-K, had to be in a harness when he went to public pre-K, could never stay within a normal classroom in elementary school for more than a few months without causing extreme problems. They tried to put him into a normal middle school. He lasted about a year and a half there with reasonable behavior, but past that point, he was suspended every other day in middle school, was talking about guns seemingly every day, would talk to students about animals that he killed, would bring weapons to school, would say things in class, you're studying history, and ask a question like, what did it sound like when Abraham Lincoln died? Did it go pop, pop, or pop, pop really fast? And what do they do with the bodies after the Civil War? Did people eat them? So this was an extremely disturbed student who everybody in the middle school was terrified about. But it's so hard to get a student like him into a specialized school, right? Because he's labeled as having an emotional and behavioral disability. And federal law and local implementation of that pressure schools to educate students with disabilities in the least restrictive environment possible. They finally managed to get him into a specialized school where he tells his therapist that he has dreams of killing and being covered in blood. When asked what he likes, teachers tend to say guns or the military. But after a few calm months there, they decide, okay, he's ready to go back to a normal school, and he seems to have an interest in guns and the military, so let's put him in JROTC. So, you know, Broward County, knowing full well the history of this child, his fixation on guns and killing, his extreme disturbance, thought to themselves, let's put him in a traditional high school where he can practice shooting. So they literally gave him a gun.
I want to come back to what you talked about, the emotionally disturbed, behaviorally and emotionally disturbed aspect. But first, there are all these signs. Did anyone pick it up correctly and say, we have a real problem here? We got to get this kid into institutional care. He should not come back to the school or anything like that. Was there any adult who saw what was going on for what it was, that this was a potential murderer in the midst?
There was one who tried and was overruled. Her name was Tara Bone. She was a special ed support specialist at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. And halfway through his first semester of being partially mainstreamed there, she got an email saying, can you please talk to his teachers to collect information about him in preparation for sending him here full time? And she had never heard of him, had never seen his records. When she gets them, she sees the repeated reference to guns. She sees everything that's kind of disturbing in his history. And she said that she approached school administrators and said, this is bad, 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 bad. This student should not go here. and was told by an assistant principal, stay in your lane. This is not your decision to make. Like, you don't make the calls around here. And at the end of the day, she didn't have the authority to. She was, according to her, the only person during the transfer who had actually read his files. The assistant principal who told her to stay in the lane had not read his paperwork. It appears as though the special ed specialist who was the primary point person on him had not either. So this huge record that he had went basically unread. The one woman who read it objected and was told to stay in your lane and was overruled. And she, she almost feels sympathy for him. And from her perspective, they threw him to the wolves by putting him in a setting that he obviously wasn't equipped to do.
We're talking to Max Eden. He's the co-author with Andrew Pollack, P-O-L-L-A-C-K. Max Eden is M-A-X-E-D-E-N. The book is Why Meadow Died. I'm just curious about this teacher or special ed support person. Where is she now, and does she talk about this?
She is in Tennessee now. She moved out of Broward County altogether between, her fear of the students and the change in work conditions she described after she tried to object. She left Marjory Stoneman Douglas. She left Broward. She left Florida. It was extremely difficult to get her. It was pretty difficult to get her to talk to us at all. A lot of people in the aftermath of this fear liability, fear, being blamed. And to my knowledge, she hasn't spoken to anybody but us about it. But, in the book, the story is out there. It's told.
I want to talk about three layers, three levels: students, police, security, and then the national level, and the things you were hinting at earlier. What was the killer's reputation among the students at the high school, some of whom he killed, many of whom he killed? Did they regard him as crazy boy, as a crazy guy?
Yeah, I mean, before the shooting was over, according to teachers, it was already on Snapchat that this was him, wasn't it? There was one student who told the police that he went outside of the school, saw the shooter who had dropped his gun, exited the building, and thought about saying to him, "Oh, I thought you were supposed to be the one to shoot up the school," but then didn't because he remembered how crazy this kid was and didn't think that would be safe to say to him. In middle school, he was a well-known kind of screaming, shrieking terror. In high school, there was a smaller footprint, but a deeper one. He threatened to kill students. He threatened to rape at least one. He wrote, "I hate the N-word" on his backpack and paraded through school. He etched swastikas into lunchroom tables. I mean, it wasn't just the staff that thought this could be the kid who shoots up the school. Like, the students, everybody who knew him knew that as well.
Police, there was a lot of discussion of the chief, the security guard, not paying attention or not doing what he should have done. We started with that. What about the police behavior or lack of proper behavior overall? What kind of responsibility there?
I'll take one step kind of between that, between the school and the police, right? Because there was this agreement that the school district and the sheriff's office entered into known as the Promise Agreement, the explicit intention of which was to reduce student arrests in school. And, in the schools, they went so far as to literally train principals to refuse to cooperate with local law enforcement if they come on campus. But within the schools, everybody got the memo that you're not supposed to arrest. I mean, this is a student who was deemed so dangerous, and this last fact came out after the book went to print, that not only did school administrators prohibit him from wearing a backpack, but they also frisked him every day to make sure that he wasn't carrying a deadly weapon. And yet, he wasn't arrested in school, nor was he arrested outside of school. There were 45 calls to his house in the course of his life, some about his brother, some about him, and none of these calls resulted in an arrest, in part because the same attitude of let's fight the so-called school-to-prison pipeline by reducing arrests also seeped into the community. Sheriff Scott Israel said repeatedly and somewhat famously, "We judge our success not by the number of students we put in, number of juveniles we put in jail, but by the number of juveniles we keep out of jail." And, by that metric, which is obviously an inappropriate one, you should be judged by how safe you keep the community. The shooter was a great success story up until February 14th.
Yeah.
At one point, one police officer received a call from a concerned mom saying, my kid told me that on Instagram she saw that he said, "I'm going to get this gun and shoot up the school." And that officer's reaction was to tell her, quite wrongly, "Well, that's protected by the First Amendment." And the mom's like, "Well, how do we keep him from getting a gun?" "Well, that's protected by the Second."
Talk, because I got a couple more questions and I'm looking at the clock. the educratic dimension. This what you've just described, and this policy and these set of policies were recognized, given national recognition and the superintendent awards for this, which all seemed fine until that date in February.
Yeah, this became the model for the nation. Right, Superintendent Runcie had worked for Arnie Duncan when Arnie Duncan was superintendent of Chicago. Duncan becomes Secretary of Education. Runcie, who had never been a teacher or a principal, becomes superintendent of the sixth largest school district in America, puts forward these proposals, the Promise Program, other leniency initiatives around that to fight the school-to-prison pipeline by lowering discipline. And shortly thereafter, Arnie Duncan, as Secretary of Education, kind of takes these policies and uses a Dear Colleague letter to pressure and coerce schools through threat of losing federal funding to follow suit. So it's not an exaggeration to say that the policies that led to the Parkland shooting have been spread largely in secret to schools serving millions, if not tens of millions, of students across the country.
So what happened at Parkland in terms of the policies could be happening at schools, is happening at schools all over the country.
No, is happening at schools.
Is happening.
Hopefully it never leads to another school shooting. It never occurred to me, having studied this issue before, that it could. But
yeah,
this pressure to, you know, decrease discipline by not recording is national now. There was a poll by the Fordham Institute found that 70% of teachers think that their school has lowered suspensions in part by tolerating more misbehavior. About 50% think that they have reduced discipline by simply not recording. So these same dynamics that let this dangerous kid slip through the cracks that cause disruption, disorder, and lower level violence are happening in schools across the country because of the way these policies have spread.
Where is Superintendent Runcie today?
He is still the leader of the Broward Public School District. Some of the families ran directly for school board to try to change the policies and oust him. They lost rather roundly, and so he is still leading the school system.
Are they reevaluating this leniency that they've been?
No, they are not. They're digging in their heels. You know, at this point, the state commission has recommended that the Promise Program be abolished. The local newspaper, which leans pretty far left, has recommended that it be abolished. But the school board is quite dug in on this, and I don't think anything will make them change or reconsider, except perhaps for a grand jury investigation that Florida Governor DeSantis launched, that if he can confirm some things that we have found and suspect could lead to indictments, as has happened in Broward before.
This is what you've just described as an ethos of the schools. Michael Rutter was the first educationist I knew who used that term in a persuasive way, the habits of people in the place and the habits in the bureaucracy, and you've well chronicled that, Max. Is there another ethos we need to pay attention to? I was reading the other day, and I can't remember exactly, but sometime in the 80s or 90s, 85% or 90% of people who had been in mental institutions were let out. And the deinstitutionalization, is this in the air as well, that we should not make it a lot harder to put people, even when there are alarm bells, to put people into safe environments where they can't hurt anybody? Is that against the grain of the culture right now?
No, it absolutely is. And, you know, the book focuses more on the school, but it has to be said for every listener who wants to understand the story and, you know, this ethos, that the week of the shooter's 18th birthday, the local mental health authorities were called to evaluate him three times when he was behaving erratically in the home, when he told a friend that he was drinking gasoline and cutting himself, and when he wrote "kill" at the top of his schoolwork and explained that he was in a fight with his mom about wanting to get a gun when she didn't want to let him. And so three times in one week, the mental health authorities, who had a long history with this individual, were called out to look at him. And each time they decided, oh, you know, he doesn't even merit temporary observation because he denies a plan to hurt himself or others. You know, if we talk a lot about background checks, but if we're unwilling to deem juveniles as criminals and we're unwilling to tag them as psychopaths, then background checks will be totally useless. And both ethos were strongly at work here and are strongly at work in other places.
One of the most interesting parts of the book, I thought, in reading the draft and then reading the actual book, is beginning of part three, the politically correct school district. Tell us, I think you have 40 things, something like that, 33,
yeah,
35?
42, and we left off, you know, somewhat 42. Early. I mean,
what are five or six So we don't have time for all 42 things that could have been done, should have been done, that would have saved the lives of these students. Kind of more obvious, the better. Obviously, these were the things to do in retrospect.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, a kid who has a long history of homicidal ideation and extremist behavior should not be put in traditional high school and taught to shoot a gun.
Fair point.
Obviously, a student who continues to threaten to kill his peers and threatens to shoot up a school while he's at a traditional high school should be sent back to that traditional high school, should be sent back to that special high school. Obviously, a student, a juvenile to whose house the police are called 45 times should be arrested at least once. Obviously, a school that boasts of being safe and having a single point of entry shouldn't leave the gates unlocked. And obviously, a security officer who sees him walk in, whose sole job it is to immediately report potential threats, should report it.
What's the takeaway in the sense of anybody listening who's got kids in school? What do they ask to find out? Where do they go? Who do they talk to find out about policies which may be inviting danger and violence of this sort? What should people do? Citizens, parents.
Yeah, the key thing to do is to talk to teachers, right? I mean, in anonymous polls in Broward and in other districts I've looked at, teachers will say things like, this student threatened to kill me or assaulted another student, and he was put back in my class the next day. But they're not willing to say it on the record for fear of retaliation. I mean, it's this ethos that we just need to not punish. So parents need to ask their teachers, are these policies at play? Are these dynamics at work? And if they are, parents need to go to their school board members and object to it vociferously, go en masse and say, we know that our kids aren't safe because our teachers are telling us so. They're not willing to go on record because they're scared of their principals. Something is deeply wrong here, and we demand that these policies be rolled back.
Got it. Got it. Why Meadow Died, Andrew Pollack and Max Eden. Very important piece of deep and thoughtful, detailed journalism with very powerful set of points. Thank you, and congratulations to you, Max.
Thank you so much, Bill.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
Let's welcome Joel Farkas. He's a director of the American Strategy Group, a very successful businessman, and an observer of the cultural scene. Time for brilliance.
Okay, let's be that.
Okay, let's talk about trade. You and I were talking on the phone, not on a podcast, and I just mentioned to you, I said a friend of mine, former colleague, Vin Weber, on a podcast last week, said, you know, I said, if Trump doesn't get the China deal, trade deal, for Election Day next year, could be real bad for him. He said, I don't know. I'm not so sure. He said, I think a lot of people, A, appreciate what he's doing, that he's standing up for America and people haven't, and challenging China. I thought that was an interesting point. You pointed out one more dimension to this negotiation, and you've talked about several dimensions. Please, Joel.
I agree with him. There's no mystical magic as to why the United States and China need to have this ever-expanding, ever-growing trade. I understand China's a big country. It's 1.4 billion people. But, you know, India's a big country. Vietnam is a growing country. You know, growth is important. Many other countries in Southeast Asia are important, and they're growing. And what you keep hearing is just what you said. If there is no agreement with China, then disaster looms. Not true. There's no agreement with China. What that means is the United States can, over time, move their source of goods, manufactured goods, somewhere else. And that somewhere else might not only be India or Vietnam. It might be the United States itself. It doesn't have to be China. The United States economy, 67% of our economy is generated by consumer consumption, consumer spending. It's not the same in China. A lot of most of their economy is by exports and manufacturing. So I agree with what your other guest said. It's not the end of the world. The media would like to characterize it as such, but it's not.
What about, but let me just stop you for a second. The things I've heard, one, well, the farmers, you know, you can say, well, gradually over time, you can maybe send stuff to India or somewhere else. But man, there's some real losses here, you know, immediately and substantial. I mean, I've seen people, you know, saying this on TV. I don't think the president's denying that. I mean, he's also talked about something like $11 billion that, you know, they're putting forward to help those farmers.
The president is not denying the fact that the farmers are getting hurt by not selling agricultural products to China. That's true. I'm in the real estate business, in the energy business. There's not a day that goes by that some local jurisdiction, some county, some state, some federal agency is trying to not only disrupt my business, but shut it down. It happens every single day, every single week. And the purpose that they give for trying to restrict or shut down what I do is to protect the health and safety and welfare of the community. Right? That's their stated purpose. And what do I do with that information? What do I do with those facts? It's not even information. What do I do with that set of circumstances? I have to modify how I do what I do. And what you do, when you modify it, what you do is you go and you find other sources, other places to either sell your product or either get the supplies to manufacture and distribute your product. This is what you learn in the first year of business and economics school, that you do not depend on one source of a customer. You do not depend on one source of a supply. So, yes, I understand the farmers are having difficulty, and just like I have difficulty each and every time someone wants to cease energy production or cease real estate development, we have to work on finding other ways of doing this. Now, the CEOs that have a bigger megaphone than the farmers, who are complaining about, we have a supply chain being disrupted, and this is catastrophic for free trade. Well, to those CEOs, I would say, if you are relying exclusively or substantially on China to sell what you are making, or if you are relying on China to manufacture and distribute substantially most of what you are selling in the United States, you did not learn what you should have learned in business school. And for that, you should be fired. You should not do that. You should have multiple supply chains and multiple customers. It's just basic.
Okay. The words Walmart flashed before my eyes when you were saying that.
Yeah, Walmart. When Walmart started, Sam Walton started Walmart, there's two basic tenets. Number one is he went to small town America, towns of 50 to 100,000 people, to build Walmarts, not the big ones. Second thing, he used to have a big advertising campaign, Made in the USA. That's what Walmart used to be. Walmart's evolved.
Really?
They now, yeah, Made in the USA, big advertising campaign. Now they have gotten bigger, larger, something of substantial scale, which is what you hear in, you hear that argument in Silicon Valley all the time, the big scale argument. How do you scale something to be ubiquitous all over the world? Well, guess what happens? They're big. They're a good company, and they now source much of their supply from China. Well, they got to change. What we're really talking about here are what you hear about every single day, which is a tariff that the president is putting on goods manufactured in China. A tariff. What is a tariff? It's a charge. It's a fee. It's a cost. Deal with tariffs all the time. And I have everywhere I work a lot in the Denver metropolitan area. The Denver metropolitan area for real estate has 10 counties and more than 60 jurisdictions. 10 counties, 60 jurisdictions. Every one of them have a different fee, a different charge, a different process. The range of a water tap could be from $12,000 to $50,000. Well, if you want to supply something that's less expensive, don't go to the place where they charge $50. Go to the place where they charge $12. It's the same thing with if you're a big company and you're dealing with China. If the regulatory environment is changing, go somewhere else.
But I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just asking the questions because I didn't go to business school.
Yeah.
And I don't practice business, except monkey business, funny business, talky business. Anyway, but okay, so Walmart has changed, but that's a major disruption. I mean, if all of a sudden they're, paying 20% tariffs on what they get from China, that's a lot of goods and it's going to be passed on to the consumer. That's going to take a while and it's going to cost Walmart and their customers some money, right?
Yeah, it is. And I would say, again, if Walmart did not anticipate there could be changes, it's their fault. Their fault. No one else's. There was a lot of other companies that we're not reading about that have been diversifying. And I wrote a paper in college that I almost got a C on, and I went to the professor and he said, "You're lucky I gave you a C. I should have failed you."
Really?
And it was on this particular topic. exactly this topic. And he explained to me, which I don't know if you want to hear about my professor's explanation of my paper, but it was on this topic about a company I was analyzing that had a sole product against that the users were using a single source of a machine, and that everything was dependent on all these things and there was no other alternative. And I said, what a great company, because it's been growing so much and it became one of the most prominent, famous companies of the day of late 70s, early 80s. The company that I'm talking about was a company called Storage Technology. They manufactured tape drives to be used on an IBM mainframe computer. My professor said, this is the silliest argument I've ever seen, that this is a good company. You know, it started out at $2.50 stock price, went up to $40. And I said, it's going to keep going. He said, what happens if IBM is no longer the prominent company? What happens if mainframe computing is no longer there? What happens if IBM decides to provide tape drives lower cost than this company? Yeah. What happens if all these things happen? And I said, you know, I didn't think of that.
Right.
And my professor was right. He says, I hope in the future when you go into business, you think of those things.
Yeah. Good. Got it. You know, I have to tell you just one anecdote, although not business, but it's reports of business. We were talking about doing business in China on the radio show a few years back. Claude's sitting here. Claude will remember this too. And I said, tomorrow morning from 6 to 9, if any of you have ever done business in China, give us a call. We'd like to know your experience. Almost without exception, everybody said it was terrible. They didn't get paid. Yeah. They got paid less. People didn't show up. Things changed. Contracts weren't honored and so on and so on and so on. Well, what lured you to it? Well, the numbers. What, you had a billion customers, right? Or 800 million customers, right. Whatever the number is.
Right.
So, man, if I could that 3% of the market, you know how the thinking goes. But this is exactly
the same. They have an Excel spreadsheet. Right. 3% of 1.4 billion. Oh, my God, it's great.
Yeah, but not looking at it.
The siren song to go there.
So, but what you're saying is that businesses should know better. And for a lot of them, it's their own fault if this is punitive.
Yeah. So the story I just told you about Storage Technology and IBM, that was in 1981. I wrote that paper. 3 years later, Storage Technology filed for bankruptcy. In about that same time, IBM had dramatic disruption. Who was their disruptor? It was Microsoft. Yeah. Personal computing replaced the mainframe computer. My professor was correct.
Yeah.
Silicon Valley likes to talk about disruptive technology. And people benefit from them. Well, for goodness sake, Nike, if there's going to be disruption of the regulatory environment in China, manufacture shoes somewhere else, and you should have been knowing that, not being dependent upon.
Should have thought of that earlier. This was not, I take it, the same professor who was at Yale Business School or Harvard Business School gave Fred Smith a D for his idea that became FedEx.
No, it wasn't. Different one.
All right, your guy was smart, right?
By the way, I remember him because I had very few smart professors, but this guy had the spine to tell a budding student, your paper is terrible and you need to rethink it. And he didn't pat me on the head and say, good. Good job. Keep doing it.
Good. You know the story I'm referring to with Fred Smith, right? You've heard that.
Yes. Yeah. It's worth retelling. It's a great story.
Yeah. And he had that great idea. He stayed with it. And it was a good idea. You know, we were going to talk about California. I told the audience we would, but let's stay with this because this is very interesting. Some of the smart companies and businesses right now, I would guess then, Joel, are doing just what you recommended, which is starting to shift the supply chain, let's diversify our manufacturer. If our only manufacturing is going on in China, let's start looking elsewhere. Would that be right? That would be the prudent thing to do, correct?
It's the prudent thing to do, and it's exactly what they are doing. And, you know, our president would like to see, because he's made no secret, he wants to see this manufacturing back in the United States. But he also, more importantly, and this is the issue with his position against China, with China in the trade, he doesn't want to be trading. If we're going to be trading with a foreign country, he doesn't want to be ripped off. He doesn't want to have businesses stolen from.
Right.
He doesn't want to have the Chinese government taking proprietary secrets and making it part of the state-owned enterprises. He doesn't want any of that to happen, regardless of whether or not a business thinks the next quarter needs to report, you know, increasing sales and increasing margins. He doesn't want things to be stolen and co-opted by state-owned enterprises.
So you cheer him on in this effort, right?
I absolutely do cheer him on. I in my small little world of local government and county government and state government, and you know, I have also nonprofit organizations trying to put every 2 years on a ballot in a state, in a jurisdiction, in a county, some sort of thing that creates a moratorium or increased restrictions to what I do. Every single 2 years since I've been in business, I deal with the fact that the regulatory winds change, and that's just been a part of what we do in our industries of real estate and energy. Again, the environmental groups would like to cease expanding development, would like to cease production of oil and gas. Their stated objective is health, safety, and welfare. Well, the President of the United States has made it very clear. The stated objective is to protect the United States and United States business from having their products, having their industry stolen by another country. This country is not adhering to their contracts, to their agreements. How in the world could I possibly say that's bad for America? And by the way, while industries are being disrupted, yes, those are issues. But if you're a CEO, you darn well better understand that these things happen. And if you cannot understand that and you want to whine that you didn't, the board should actually meet. Emergency session and fire if you can't understand that.
Yeah. How do you think this is going to turn out, Joel?
Well, first of all, what we're hearing, the method of attacking the president is we're now going to have a recession. We're going to have this inverted yield curve,
the economists keep describing.
That's their method of attacking him. Well, you know, 2 years ago when President Trump was running for office, there was something called the Phillips curve. Every 2 years, the economists come up with another curve to discuss. What's the Phillips curve? It said President Trump was running saying that there's more people that need to be working. Unemployment is still too high. And I'm going to bring back jobs to America so more people work and reduce unemployment. What did every single business channel say? What did every single liberal attack dog say? What did every economist say when President Trump said that? They said he obviously doesn't understand the Phillips curve, which is the relationship between unemployment and inflation. The economist said there's an optimal amount of unemployment. Any unemployment less than that amount will trigger inflation and will have a rampant problem in the economy. Well, what was their optimal amount? They have a fancy term. It's called the non-accelerated inflation rate of unemployment. It was 4.9%, the economist declared. 4.9%, that's optimal. Anything less, inflation. Well, today, inflation is about 1.5%. Unemployment's about 3.7%.
Son of a gun.
The economy is good. They're wrong. They're wrong. So now you don't hear about the Phillips curve anymore. You don't hear about that topic. You hear about inverted yield curves. Well, the bond market, all of a sudden, everybody is becoming an expert on bonds. In the bond market, there are many countries in Asia and Europe who are selling bonds that have a zero or negative yield. And again, the economists are hysterical about it. One thing you have never heard them say is, who has the bonds that are yielding positive returns? 95% of all bonds in the world that yield a positive return are in the United States of America. We have the strongest economy, the lowest unemployment, the best growth of any country in the world. I'm sorry it's a long answer, but the answer to your question, what's going to happen in the next 12 months, the economy is going to be good. People are going to be working, and the predictions of economists are going to, once again, be incorrect.
Will you get a deal?
I hope that if President Trump gets a deal, it's a good deal. I hope he doesn't just do a deal, because the United States economy can sustain no deal, and it certainly will prosper with a deal. But I hope this is the first time in my lifetime that I've seen a president stand up to a major superpower who was who is stealing from our country.
Very good. Very good. Very good. Joel, thank you very much. We'll return to California next time in a couple of weeks, maybe. Is that okay?
That would be great. Thank you so much.
This was really, really good. Thank you.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show. Bill Bennett
Show. Well, folks, that does it for today's show. To catch up on previous episodes of the show, go to BillBennettShow.com. You can follow me on Twitter at William J. Bennett, and you can like me on Facebook. Just search Bill Bennett. Feel free to email the show. I'd love to hear from you. It's BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com. Please share the podcast with your family and share with your friends and share with your people who disagree with you. Be ready for Thanksgiving.
Right.
Thanksgiving.
Well, yeah, I mean, Thanksgiving is coming up in September. It's early September, but I mean, you got to start planning.
You got to start planning.
Right. Yeah. Has Mrs. Bennett started the
list?
The test turkeys yet?
Test turkeys. We'll catch up next week. Thank you so much for listening.